This is a digital recording of the Academic Senate of January 26, 2012.
Membership, Maria Hess, returning from sabbatical as secretary. Welcome back. Hold your applause till the end. Terry Meese is returning to his position as senator from the School of Business at PCOM from his one semester stint as secretary. Michaela Vogel is returning to her at-large senator position. I think also puts back to it. We have an interesting situation this semester with Senator Roberts, who is filling two roles. She's now our senator as well as chair of APC. Since one person can't hold two positions on the Senate, despite the fact that she has two hands, we would be happy to vote twice. APC has designated that portion of the chair role to Professor.
Right there?
Kaluji Callahan. Yes, that's way too small for you. So, welcome to the Senate as the ABC chair. Merlin Hanauer is replacing Lawrence Bouvet for the spring semester here. And Michael Kingston is the new emeritus senator for the United States. All right. So, real quickly, report from me a few things. Senator Lee.
May I make a comment on this transition thing?
Yes.
Thank you. Point of personal privilege, just wanted to do the proper tool thing. I know that everybody here knows that Laura records these things and does the minutes and everything like that, but I don't know that everybody knows those minutes before they come out, so you go through the secretary. And so in the everything, the flow of not being used to this and everything, at the end of last semester, this overwhelmed me and I did a bad job. So Laura was much better about getting minutes done than what the stack of minutes that you got this week reflects. And I would like to apologize to Laurel and apologize to all of you and thank Maria for coming back. So Laurel has done a really good job with minutes. Just there was a bottleneck, and the bottleneck was me. So again, really apologize to Laurel for this wonderful job. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Senator Lee.
Thank you.
All right. So a few things for me to report on. The provost has asked the Senate Budget Subcommittee to take on the task of recommending to him some guiding principles for budget allocations within academic affairs. And so the Budget Subcommittee has taken on that task for the spring, which is a big task for it. It will be meeting next week to get going on that. It's, as you probably saw at the end of last semester, it asked structure and functions to appoint to sitting department chairs to augment the budget subcommittee, since that was an important role not represented on the subcommittee. So that group starts next week. We'll try to keep you informed as to what's going on with those discussions. The Green Music Center Advisory Board continues to meet this season. The opening season will be announced in mid-March. The University Affairs Subcommittee of the Green Music Center Advisory Board, which consists primarily of faculty with other university constituencies also represented, is meeting in early February, and that's the body that starts with figuring out the tie between the academic mission and the Green Music Center. And so each of your schools has representatives on that group. Please talk to them or me if you have ideas, concerns, issues there. And finally, Alex Boyer, the president of Associated Students, and Dan Conrad and I had lunch today with Jake McKenzie, the new mayor of Orland Park, who is anxious to work with any and all of us who are interested in community partnerships. He's a longtime supporter of Sonoma State, and dearly love to hear about any projects that you have going on in the community, and would love to help support them. So if you have things sent his way, early is better than him reading about in the newspaper. I think that's it for my report. Any questions of me? All right, we'll go on to the agenda. So, First of all, are there any reports that would like time served? I've got the statewide senators down for a 3:30 time served. Any other? Okay. Any others? Okay. Let's see. So, the chair of EPC, I have family emergency today and couldn't be here, and nobody else on the committee could be here to represent EPC. The chair of the GE subcommittee is able to be here to do business item number 2, but business item number 3, I'd like to ask if there's any objection to postponing that to the next Senate meeting. That's the calendar guideline revisions. We've already seen next year's academic calendar, so this is the long-term guidelines going forward, and since EPC has had long discussions about this, it seems important that they be represented in that discussion. So if there's no objection, I'd like to take business item 3 off the agenda. Yeah. Any other changes to the agenda? All right, any objection to considering it approved? All right, so the agenda is done with business item number 3. We have 3 sets of minutes to look at from November 10th, December 1st, and December 15th. Are there any comments or corrections to any of those? So, Senator Brodsky was quoted at the end of the December 1st minutes, and she maybe she actually wants to stick with that quote, but the one that's in there wasn't quite accurate. So in the current put of the order at the end of the December 1st minutes, it went, Senator Brodsky informed us of music happening at the library. She invited us to bring our lunch or to bring them lunch. And,
bring you.
And Laurel added martinis and turkey sandwiches. So.
Of which we're not opposed.
So
there will be more music.
Any other corrections, changes to the minutes? Okay, I'd like to do them all at once. Are there any objections to approving all 3 sets of minutes? All right, those are approved. I've received no correspondence, and so we'll move on to the first agenda item, which is the consent item. So, the first sheet in your packet consists of 2 letters, and the Executive Committee is presenting to the Senate a list of 3 faculty members who completed their service in the fall who are now eligible for emeritus status. And this was unanimously approved by the Executive Committee. All 3 names, the 2 appear on the first page and 1 on the back of that page. And Executive Committee requested a review from FSAC of the 3rd name because of a technicality in the policy that requires retirement from Sonoma State in order to be eligible. In this case, Dr. Rose was not eligible to retire technically from Sonoma State because she had already retired from another CSU. But given that FSAC recommended that her situation meets the intent of the policy, which was to recognize with emeritus status a faculty member who was completing service and completing their teaching career here after at least 10 years service. So there are 3 names on the list, and I'd like to ask if there's any objection to approving that. Okay, so if we're going to discuss it, we need to pull it off and make it an agenda item.
It wasn't a discussion, it's a piece of information.
I don't have an objection, I have a question.
Okay, go ahead with a question.
My question is, I think we should have a discussion of how to deal with people who retire due to disability, who may not meet all the criteria for emeritus or now stand. And I was wondering how that could be brought up or perhaps referred to the faculty standards in the Bureau Committee. But I think it's something that other CSUs do have in their emeritus guidelines, and I think we should look at that because there are people who brought it to my attention because of being co-chair of the Senate Diversity Subcommittee, they felt that perhaps there are people who think of disability retirement should be considered. I don't know where else to bring that up.
Right. Okay. So I think I will put that on the next executive committee agenda to consider whether we want it before that.
I just wanted to add that it didn't show in the letter. This was a unanimous decision of the committee that FSACs went and forwarded it to XCOM.
So is there any objection to approving the list of three names of board as eligible for inheritance status? Thank you. So we'll move on to congratulations and thanks for years of excellent service. So we move on to let's see how I am time. Let's do business item number one, disruptive student behavior policy. Adabi?
Yes. So you might remember at the end of December, very cold in here. And it has been a very long meeting. I don't think anyone was much paying attention to this disruptive behavior policy. But here it is for the second reading. I just wanted to remind you of a couple things about the policy, which is in your packet. There aren't any changes to it from last time, so you don't need to worry about that too much. But I wanted to remind you that these really are guidelines to help faculty deal with disruptive behavior so that teaching and learning can continue in the classroom. The authority for these is Executive Order 1043. And also the California State Title V, Section 41301. It's really our intent to keep the policy and the procedure separate, and I just wanted to remind you of that as well. Some of the procedures are outlined in Executive Order 1023 and referenced in the policy, and other procedures will be developed in the future once the policy is passed to give better guidelines to students and faculty.
So what we're deciding is whether to recommend this policy to the president of the university policy. What will you know as a blue paper policy? Yes, Senator Russell.
Yes, I'd like to offer an amendment to that. On the paragraph B, the very first sentence, paragraph, if you will, dangerous behavior, etc. I'd like to suggest that we substitute that with the following text. In the event of dangerous behavior, the responsible faculty member should ensure police services are notified immediately and then take prudent measures to minimize the danger until the police arrive. I believe that someplace in here we need to recognize that the faculty member is responsible.
Is there a second to that? Okay, so that's been moved and seconded, so that amendment is what's before us now.
Okay. See if they weren't currently. Not having to vote, but I'm concerned about the last part of it said what? Can you repeat the last phrase?
Let me just read the whole thing just to be sure. Okay. In the event of dangerous behavior, the responsible faculty member should ensure police services are notified immediately and then take prudent measures to minimize the danger until the police arrive.
That seems to be a real setup. If something goes wrong, that seems to be setting the faculty up for something that they might not have any control over whatsoever. I'm concerned about suggesting that, that until the police arrive, the faculty member might have to be the policeman. I realize that prudent is a way to protect it, but I'm not sure that that's our responsibility. And in a situation where you have dangerous behavior, all kinds of things can happen. So I think we need to be very, very cognizant of the fact that we might be setting our colleagues up for something that is unintended and negative.
Other conversation on this amendment? Looks like a question from Senator Byrne.
Is it would be suitable that an adjustment from this be made by the maker of the motion that the take account of the reservation that is presented?
Do you have a suggestion for the change?
My suggestion would be to eliminate the term "take approval." Action to eliminate the behavior.
Yeah, we can't hear Kevin.
My suggestion is that, in light of the point made by the CFA president, I think it's well taken that it might be best to eliminate words that charge the faculty member with responsibility of taking prudent action until police arrive. Prudent action to eliminate the behavior until arrive, if I recall the great theology.
So, just saying to eliminate the behavior as opposed to minimize the danger.
Let me try to rephrase what I understand. The amendment that Senator Rosen proposed is to replace that sentence with, in the event of dangerous behavior, the responsible faculty members should ensure police services are notified immediately and then take prudent measures to minimize the danger until police arrive. Senator Byrne is proposing to remove the second half of that sentence. Correct.
That is my suggestion.
So then it would just read, in the event of dangerous behavior, the responsible faculty member should ensure police services are notified immediately. So that's an amendment to the amendment. Is there a second to that? Okay, I don't hear one. So we're still discussing the full amendment that Senator Rosen made. Okay. Senator Roberts?
Thank you. So, in my line of work, it is not unusual to have unsafe things happen in a facility, not the university, but an acute care or other type of facility. And so, for example, if there is a fire, the first thing is to just use the analogy of a patient. Is the patient out of danger? If you can, but you never want to put yourself at risk in doing that. And I think it's important to understand that with this policy is that a faculty member would never want to put their self at risk to protect anyone else in the classroom. So I think it's important for us to remember that.
Senator Nelson.
Concerns about being asked to take immediate action. I have concerns about being asked to take immediate action or notify the police immediately if somebody's bigger than I am and I can't do it. There might be some reason why I can't, and that language might set me up to be stupid because I do not.
Senator Bass.
So I thought this policy was not restricted to just the classroom. I thought it was any dangerous perhaps I misunderstood. So I don't see where there would necessarily be, if that was true, maybe I'm incorrect, maybe this is just a classroom policy, but if not, then there may not be a faculty member. And secondly, I agree with others who've spoken that I don't think faculty should be set up in a position where they're not trained or anything to deal with something that even makes sense.
Senator Shan.
I'm wondering if we might not make a distinction between the intent of this, which is dealing with disruptive behavior, and actually dangerous behavior. This is a single sentence, and perhaps we need a whole discussion and consideration of all the ramifications of dangerous behavior. But at a second reading, I'm reluctant to start adding pieces to what is a single sentence here in really another category.
I'd just like to clarify, this is a policy designed for educational settings, so that would be classrooms, field trips, things like that nature. It's not a campus-wide policy, and I appreciate Senator Shan's comments. We in FSAC and SAC have written a policy about disruptive behavior. If you want to decide on one of the charges to write a policy about dangerous behavior, I'm sure we could go back and do that.
My understanding was the purpose of having a sentence there at the beginning was just to make it clear that there is a difference between dangerous behavior and that involves emergency services or whatever. And so
it was placed there just to say, don't go digging through here if it's dangerous. This is for disruptive behavior. So I think that it is fine as stands, and we should just move to the more substantive parts of the rest of the policy. I think modifying that element on the floor, we're going to get unintended consequences, because I think there are so many implications that could open up. If we discovered that we really did need it, we could come back and add that later. But I'd like to have the rest of the policy in place while we're working that through.
Senator Barker.
Since this is a policy on disruptive student behavior, I would not see anything wrong to simply eliminate that sentence about dangerous behavior. Sometimes less is more. And if there's anything dangerous, we know how to respond in a responsible way, but not being prompted to do so to minimize complications at a later point in the interpretation of an event. So I don't see anything wrong to, and I'm not making a motion now, I'm just suggesting that, so if I have to make a motion, I will, to simply eliminate the sentence, because it just doesn't fit into a policy of disruptive student behavior.
Senator Pickstead.
As a former member of the counseling center, I really like the way this is, the disruptive part is phrased. It really makes a distinction between how things should be handled. But I would assume that it's really important for everyone to know when are the police supposed to get involved, and when they're not, or when it's helpful to call the police and dangerous people. Having some sentence like this in here tonight is makes that very clear.
So I want to remind us that the motion currently before the floor is to replace the sentence that's currently in there with the sentence, in the event of dangerous behavior, the responsible faculty member should ensure police services are notified immediately and then take prudent measures to minimize the danger until the police arrive. Senator Madhabi?
I want to point out that one reason that this line about dangerous behavior, in whichever way it goes in, is to signal the faculty that you do have the right to call the police if you feel like you're in danger. And at the same time, the rest of the policy, the bigger part that's more than one sentence, is also to signal to faculty that you have a right and you have some responsibilities in terms of how to manage disruptive behavior.
Senator Lee.
Sorry, I've got to think about that for a second. I was going to make the motion that Mr. Walters should amending the amendment simply to strike the whole sentence out. Because I think this needs to be serious consideration. There are a lot of implications to it. I think several people have talked about the if somebody fails to act what in retrospect was according to policy in a dangerous situation, you might be set up for failure. And I understand the need to or desire to avoid a Italian pollution type setting in our own or incident our own setting. But like Senator Nelson said, there may be times when we physically can't, or would be imprudent to call police services or try to call police services immediately, and afterwards have somebody say, you didn't follow your policy. I think I will move to amend that amendment by simply striking out the entire sentence.
Okay,
Senator Wilson. There's a definition of disruptive behavior here, but I don't see a definition of dangerous behavior. And if we're going to hook it up with something serious that the police can call, it really should be defined.
I'm sorry. Did you need to make a motion?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I missed that. I'm going to rule that the motion to strike the sentence is not an amendment to the amendment, but a separate amendment. So we'll finish with whether to replace the sentence first, and then I'll come back to you and let you make your motion to strike the whole sentence. So,
all the questions.
Okay, so the question, can you second to that? Second. All right, question has been called and seconded. All those in favor of ending debate on the change in that sentence, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so we move straight to a vote. So the motion is to change the sentence, dangerous behavior should immediately be reported to police services, to: in the event of dangerous behavior, the responsible faculty member should ensure police services are notified immediately and then take prudent measures to minimize the danger until police arrive. All those in favor of the change, say aye. Those opposed, say nay.
Nay.
They also were still at the original motion. I'll go back to Senator Weiss for a motion.
Move to strike the first sentence of Part 2, Paragraph D.
Well, there's a second.
Second.
Has been moved and seconded. So now, Senator Seance.
And the however with it.
What?
And the however with it.
Now, however, at the beginning of the next paragraph would go away as well.
Oh.
I would argue against that amendment, perhaps striking the word immediately, but it seems prudent and reasonable to remind people that maybe dangerous behavior should be reported to police services as soon as possible, or something like that. But I think to have at least that reference is important.
So, any more discussion on the motion to strike the whole sentence? Senator Roberts.
Thank you. I think rather than striking it, I think what I'm hearing from the group is that we're fearing for safety. We're fearing for safety. It's amazing we all teach. What do we whisper in front of the classroom? So I just want to bring that up, that I don't think we're trying to quantify what dangerous behavior is. We would all know it if we felt that our safety or the safety of anyone in the classroom was threatened.
Senator Hooker, I'd just like to speak in favor of eliminating it. Being a faculty member who goes on lots of field trips, I've seen lots of dangerous behavior in the field, and I felt confident enough to deal with that dangerous behavior on my own without having to report it to the police services immediately or otherwise. And I don't feel like I should be told that I have to do that every time the student does something inappropriate in the field, which I would consider dangerous. And again, it doesn't have that.
All right, any more discussion on the motion to strike the sentence? All those in favor of striking the sentence, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, the ayes have it, so that sentence is gone. We're back to the full motion, and we are out of time certain, so we're going to set this aside, go to our report, and come back to it. So, State Vice Senator Nelson.
Sorry, I didn't remember what I was talking about. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, I did a written report here, so you all have access to it. I just wanted to make a couple of comments about it. A couple of things in the report. First of all, the resolution, the second first reading resolution, opposition to SB 755 and SB 967 both deal with executive limits in one way or another on executive compensation. And the Fiscal Governmental Affairs Committee, the statewide Senate, is recommending opposition to those two bills because they are arguing that CSU personnel decisions should be made by the Board of Trustees, and that these bills are in fact the state legislature being involved in personnel matters located statewide. Secondly, this resolution called for creation and review on an education policy was written by Brian Wilson. I've been heard of that. With regard to the CSU budget comments from the Chancellor and Vice Chancellor Quillian, Vice Chancellor for the budget, there were two comments they made that I thought you might want to take note of, especially first of all, the Chancellor at this point is saying that no campuses will be shut down. He said that for about 6 months or a year now. I bet they changed, but at this point he's saying that. Secondly, he made an interesting comment that restricting enrollment too much will in effect decrease our revenue because tuition is high enough now that high enrollment remains a lucrative source of funds. And finally, in that report, we were informed that the Executive Council has, which is the President, has formed four committees to look into ways to manage the budget cuts. And we found out just in the last day or two that they've actually asked for faculty input, and this is one of the first times that we have seen faculty being asked to participate in conversations with presidents about budget cuts, to my knowledge. I could be wrong about that. Since I've been on the Senate, I don't recall seeing that. With regard to the conversations about shared governance, so this is one of the best shows I've ever seen, and I've been on this on a statewide Senate for the following reason. Details are in the report, but the chancellor, for the first time that I have heard, and I think this is my seventh year, actually apologized for something, and that was the delay getting back to us the Academic Freedom Amendment to the statewide Senate Constitution. The resolution about that amendment was originally introduced, I believe, last January, maybe even last November, a year ago, and more than a year ago, and as you all know, all the campuses voted on whether or not to approve that amendment as part of the Constitution over the course of last spring. It was passed by 23 campuses. It did not come to the chancellor's immediate attention until it was ready to be on the agenda of the Board of Trustees, and because they have to approve the final amendment, give the final say to any amendments to the statewide Senate Constitution, as much as the president here does to our local constitution. And the chancellor apologized, the vice chancellor for academic affairs apologized, university council apologized to the faculty affairs committee, and the assistant vice chancellor for academic affairs, Ron Vogel, who is the vice chancellor's, go-to guy for shared governance, whatever you want to call him, apologized and took the full responsibility. And again, that's the first time I have heard the chancellor apologize for anything in the 7 years I've been on the Senate. Remarkable. The second thing is that the chancellor did give the statewide Senate $50,000, for which we are all appreciative, for the 2012-2013 year. And again, this was part of the most remarkable show I've ever seen. Everybody was grateful for that. If you put together the apology and the extra money for the statewide Senate, that took a whole lot of minute out of any support there was for any strong statement of concern about the chancellor's leadership. And it was, I don't know whether it was intended to be or not, but I thought it was a really political move, and it worked. It worked so well, you wouldn't believe how well it worked. So that was part of the show I thought you might like to hear about. My understanding is that there are several campuses that are considering whether or not to do a resolution to concern about the chancellor's leadership in a variety of forms. The outcome of that conversation statewide was clearly there's no support for a resolution of no confidence, but it was suggested that the statewide Senate does have a duty and responsibility to respond to concerns expressed by local Senates. And John Tarchin out of Bakersfield, who's the former chair of the statewide Senate, suggested rather than a resolution, that a letter be sent to the Board of Trustees from the chair of the statewide Senate, pretty much indicate what the contributions we make, the concerns we have, and suggested resolutions to the situation. And there's been a subcommittee formed to figure out whether or not that's the right approach. And finally, my understanding is that Trustee Shane will be visiting Sonoma State. I have February 23, 2023. What are the exact dates, Mr. Chair? Is it 2nd, 3rd, or 22nd?
She'll be at the Senate on February 23rd, arriving, I think, that morning and available the next morning, so 23rd, 24th, I think.
Okay. My apologies for the typo. Thank you very much.
I wrote my first resolution that doesn't involve much. We noted that there are only six campuses that don't have a policy on online education, Sonoma State being one of them. But I also note that APC is making that issue. And the statewide Senate now has a base budget, which was a big breakthrough. The budget used to be pieced together, so now there's a base budget for the state Senate. The letter that Catherine is talking about would start with many of the positive things that have gone with the chancellor. So give some positive reinforcement and then sort of spell out that this is what we would really like to see in order for shared governance to work. So I think that's the approach that is going to be taken. There's no consensus that a resolution on no confidence would have any traction.
All right, any questions for the statewide senators? I see they represent America.
Yeah, I noticed that the Ruth Black, the director of Cal State Online, gave a report in which she talked about Mr. Katz's report commissioned by the CSU of the online environment, blah, 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 and the summarizes that a potential model is the Western Governors University. Did she mention either that when Mr. Katz gave a presentation last year to the Board of Trustees where he had a PowerPoint, one of the PowerPoints showed a robot saying the robot is the perfect teacher because we don't have to pay him, and thus demonstrates his utter contempt for the faculty. And then further, that did she mention that the Western Governors University has a successful model where at least they don't have to have robots because they don't have teachers at all. That in fact, if you check with Western Governors University, you will find they have mentors. And mentors assign you things to read online, and if you don't understand them and you call them back, the mentors will give you other online sites to read. That mentors definitionally do not teach. So when Ms. Black was giving this presentation, did she mention either of these things? And we are looking to a consultant who thinks we should work for nothing or become robots, or that we should emulate a university that doesn't have faculty at all. Did that come up?
No, she was not the one that mentioned Western Governors University. The reports of the Academic Affairs Committee put together a white paper on online education currently in draft form, and that is where the analysis of Western Governors University is located. And my understanding that it is, in a brief view of the executive summary, is that that is not an entirely positive recommendation. And Brian is on the committee of the reports, so perhaps it could be more specific.
Right, I'm on that committee, and the white paper is. Does not recommend that as a model.
Oh, Mr. Cass.
The Western Governors.
No, but Mr. Cass recommended this as a model, or it just came up?
Our committee has drafted a white paper on online education, and the analysis in there does not recommend the Western Governors as something that we would want to use as a model. And it was actually out of that white paper that my resolution calling for all campuses to have a policy in place if they don't already, or if they do have a policy to revise it based on the findings in this white paper. So that way Ruth Blatt would see that these campuses have policies, and it's an indication that online education is curriculum is the job of the faculty. So if we have these policies to show her, she seemed pretty savvy about these things. I think that's the way to do it, is to just show her from the bottom up that all these campuses have these policies for her to draw on as she moves forward. I don't think we can stop this train. But we can attach some of our own cars to it.
I can't imagine anybody's trying to stop online education. Would like the faculty to be paid. It's one of our mega deals.
Well, you say that, but there were some campuses that passed resolutions to stop online education.
Try to move on and see if there are more questions for the statewide senators. Oh, Senator Roberts, yes.
Thank you. Senator Wilson, would you please send to APC that resolution and white paper if you have it? That'd be terrific to help us develop our policy. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Senators. And we will go back to finish up business item number one. So, reminder, we have just removed the first sentence of section B. And other than that, the full policy. So any discussion about the policy as a whole? Seeing none, I believe we're ready for a vote. Although Dave, this is second reading, so we're voting to recommend this to the president as an official university policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. So, hey, stop being disruptive in the back. Your board is taking a moment to really pass this call. This is our new student conduct administrator, right here, Mr. Sean Johnson. He'll be receiving. Thank you very much. All right. I look forward to seeing all of your paperwork. Welcome, John. Thank you. Thank you. Are there any other guests who are here for an introduction? I don't want to make you sit through an hour of business. Okay, great. So we'll go on to business item number two, since we have a guest here for that as well. Professor Smith from the Geology Department is here as chair of the GE committee for the second reading of this GE unit policy. This is the third sheet in your packet. And so I think I'll ask him to remind us, since it's been a little while, what this policy does, and then we'll have our discussion.
Hello, everyone. So the primary purpose of this policy is basically twofold. One is to state that it is our intention at the university to limit the number of courses that a student has to take for their GE pattern to 50 courses. And the second part of this policy is to keep an eye on basically what is actually happening on the ground. And there's not a significant change going from the previous policy to the present policy, other than the fact that we've added this component that keeps track of the number of courses that are 4 units, that should be 3 units, that are present within the curriculum, and puts a cap on them if these 4-unit courses get to be too much of a problem. That cap is somewhat arbitrary. It's basically equivalent to one extra unit per student on average across the whole curriculum. And tracking over the last 7 years, we have noticed that there's very little change. In response to comments in the first reading, some changes were made. A reference was removed. There was a place where the word cap was used in the opposite sense of the meaning. It was removed. And the procedures and exceptions portions of the policy were separated out, and they're explicitly in different sections than the main passage at the top. So that's basically the introduction. Is there any questions?
So we're open to conversation. This is a second reading, so amendments are in order. Senator Jan.
So going by the statement that students should be able to complete their curriculum within 50 units, if they are caught, let's say, in area C or D between 3 and 4 unit courses, let's say they have 11 units in area C. Should they be made to take another 3-unit course, which would exceed 50 then? Or can they petition to graduate if they have 120 and everything else met and they're 1 unit short?
I believe a somewhat separate issue is that the committee is actually taking up next semester. The issue having to do with students having 11 units in C. This semester, students have been allowed to graduate with 11 units in C. This stems from the addition of courses that never, within the ANH reform, that never actually moved to 4 courses. And it's the presence of courses that are that students took at JC, for example, that are 3 units. There are several solutions to this problem, which is sort of outside of this policy that have been proposed. One that involves the addition of 1-unit courses in ANH. But we're going to have a discussion with the dean of the ANH, Eric Sosquin, to say that it's something that we're working on.
Senator Pastor,
I would just like to add, it's not just area C. Over last fall, when I was advising students, I encountered several who actually had that same problem in area B, where they fulfilled all the requirements, but they were 1 unit short. I'm not sure what the structural reason for that was, but it's not just an area C issue.
It's a problem that we probably should be be addressing.
Senator Wilson.
The last paragraph where it says exceptions, the second sentence is not accurate. Areas A and C both contain only four-unit courses. That's not an accurate statement. The music department has some three-unit C courses.
I continue to express my unhappiness with this general thing. On a number of different areas, as brought up last time, and this A3.3 is being applied to the B area as a whole, and by definition, under the current structure, if any one area went to entirely, any one sub-area in B went entirely to four-unit classes, then you automatically have a one-unit creep in there because they've got five different requirements within the D area, and the number could be much lower. I'm unimpressed by the consistency of something around 83.3 because in my area we have this expression of something about you get what you measure, and nobody's ever measured this before, and so nobody's ever had to react to that percentage before, so there's no reason to screw around with it, and they probably didn't. I move to strike everything after maintained in the second paragraph. And just have this as the guiding principle, so they should be able to complete the GE curriculum within the 50 units. And that is how changes will be evaluated.
So tell me which paragraph
reads the guiding principle. Is that students should be able to continue through maintain, starting with sense, going with the last extra units at the bottom of that column. We have all of that is struck out, removed, deleted.
All right. So is there a second to that motion?
Can I just get clear? So he's saying the rest of the paragraph or everything after?
Everything below that.
So there's a policy within with maintain.
Okay. So, Senator Winger.
No.
Okay, so we still got the full policy before us, Senator Hess. Okay,
I would argue against that motion. Last year when this came before, one of the objections was that there actually needs to be some sort of a mechanism for how that principle is enforced. And just left that way, it really makes it extremely difficult for particularly, say, people, you know, Area D or anywhere else, to have any sort of predictability about how requests for changes to course units would be reacted to by the GE subcommittee. And in fact, the procedures used by the GE subcommittee to maintain that principle could change from one chair or one composition committee to another. I just think it creates far too much uncertainty, and that was one of the reasons this language was put into the policy, was to create more predictability on the part of people teaching in areas where they may be impacted.
Senator Sagas.
Yeah, I remember us having that conversation, running into that trouble, and I think the whole idea here is to keep it from becoming arbitrary based on who's sitting on the committee, and that can really vary as to, you know, what's going to be the influence from the various schools, so it was a contention, and I remember even originally, this was a very contentious point, and so we asked for it, and we got it. And so I'm hesitant to discard all that work because I think it's carefully thought out as best as they could in the constraints.
So more conversation on the amendment, which is to strike everything after maintained in the second paragraph.
I'm not sure. In a policy, is there room for procedure and exceptions? Is that what policies address? Does policy not include procedures. It does include procedures.
It's up to us.
I would like to speak a little bit of that. I worked in the federal government for several years, always in policy-making institutions, and there were policies written that had no procedures, but typically they had implementing procedures as a separate document. I also participated in writing policies that had considerable amounts of procedure in them, so I don't think there's any hard and fast rules. That's what the policy can or does not contain procedural language. But I would argue if it's not in a policy, it needs to be formally stated elsewhere.
And as far as our practice is concerned, our policies do have procedures included.
Some of them do, although some committees have made an effort to separate them out in recent years. Senator Sands.
In general, I have seen the argument for that, and we have been increasingly moving into that direction because implementing and modifying is easier. But I see this more as a constraint on the procedures rather than the full procedure. So, we could even rename it the constraint on the, the procedures will not, violate this principle, because this is more of a principle of how we're maintaining that, the guiding principle. And this is clarifying that. So I don't see that as a full procedure. And so the only thing I would say is maybe change that word procedure, but don't change the content of that paragraph or get rid of it.
Not taking standard procedure, not procedure in there. That wasn't my point of doing this. I just say this procedure does not, in fact, do anything toward maintaining that guiding principle.
Senator Sands.
I'm also loath to get rid of all the work that was put in to give at least some guideline. Those policies where we have separated that out because it was a huge task to keep up with all the changes. This is a relatively short document. I think we decided it needs changing. I would also not want to keep, I would want to keep the exclusion of Hutchins. I presume that was done for pedagogical reasons, and it seems like a step forward. It's not perfect. We can alter it again later, but it was a definite improvement in answering all the questions we brought up.
So we're discussing the amendment, whether to end it at maintaining in the second paragraph. Any more discussion on that? All right. All those in favor of that amendment, that is removing everything below maintained in the second paragraph, raise your hand. Those opposed? Okay. That fails. So we still got the original motion in front of us. Discussion on the main motion. Senator Buckley?
I think the last sentence, the very last sentence, exception period, doesn't actually do anything in the policy. It's just sort of descriptive. It's not necessary. I think for the sake of avoiding ambiguity, it's going to pick up what our area C doesn't have that necessarily, of course,
So it's been moved to become the last sentence. Is there a second?
I'm sorry. I clarified
last two sentences.
Last two sentences of the entire policy?
Yes.
Under the exception.
Area A and policy.
So that's been moved and seconded to remove the last two sentences since they're explanatory rather than actual policy or procedure. Is there discussion on that? Okay, all those in favor of removing those two sentences, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right, so those two sentences are gone. Senator Rumsford.
I would like to have a little more flexibility than this procedure articulates. I think that there could be strong, I understand the reason for a cap, and I think it's a good rationale. It seems to me, though, that there could still be pedagogical reasons that could supersede the cap. It wouldn't be such a unilateral rule, and we wouldn't ever cross that threshold, in other words. I imagine a scenario where, therefore, you would have to scramble to get a one-unit course or a two-unit course pushed through so that you could move what should be a four-unit course to four units. From a three-unit, right? So you're like, okay, let's get a couple of one-unit, two-unit things pushed through GE so we can have our course the way that it actually should be taught, right? So what I would like to propose is that could we change the last sentence of the procedure section to if three unit percentage falls below the limit, the GE subcommittee will strike the rest and say will require a greater threshold of rationale to approve any new four unit courses.
Is there a second to that motion?
Second.
So if the group is seconded that the last sentence of the procedure paragraph read, if three unit percentage falls below the limit, the GE subcommittee will require a greater threshold of rationale for to approve any new four unit courses. All right, discussion on that motion.
I think that sort of cuts the whole teeth out of the whole policy that makes that threshold totally arbitrary.
Any more conversation on that?
Totally support Senator Buckley's comment that we have now justified putting this in here for the predictability and then yank the predictability with some vague thing, greater justification, greater level of justification. And that all started with some talk about having to rush the 1-2 unit courses, which aren't even talked about in this policy, that seem to have no effect on the health procedures.
More conversation on this agenda. Those in favor of replacing the last part of the last sentence in the policy, say aye. Opposed? So, please go about the sentence as it is in there. And Senator Vance, on the main motion.
I have a question. Given that Area C also has 30 and 40 of the courses, should Area C be added into the first sentence
the procedure for Area C, D, and E? Would that come under the same guidelines, or is there, I'm sort of asking the GE chair. So in the current pattern of the Area C, of course, the pattern is designed so that all of the courses are 4 years. The problem that we have there, there are some three-year courses in there that make it so the students don't get the full amount of credits that they need in the unit three. But there's no issue having to do with unit three or having to do with making their course look larger when it stems from that batch. So I would consider it a separate issue.
Senator Watt?
I also just had a question rather than a suggestion. It's hard to get your head around, but it seems like within Area D, there are two categories that are fulfilled by very, very few classes. And so they're the ones that are way up at the 100% threes, right? And then there are a few that have a bunch of classes, lots and lots and lots of variation, and they have lots and lots of variation in terms of how many units they're being offered at. So it almost seems like lumping all of this into, you say, okay, 83.3 is the number, or whatever you change from that, doesn't capture that the sort of apparent pedagogical difference between the sub areas within D or E for that matter. And I guess, you know, like I said, I don't have a suggestion that, you know, 80% would be better or 75, but that 83 seems almost artificially high because of the steadiness of the very few classes you're talking about with 2 and 3.
So I'm not sure if those questions you want to respond to.
I would just state that I think that the number 83 is arbitrary. That's what you wanted to have that as be a different number. That I don't see why that would change the overall structure of the policy.
Senator Beast.
Oh, let me try this again. I move to. Let's see if I can do this. That middle paragraph, or the second paragraph, starts with the guiding principle. I move to delete the first two sentences, leaving only the sentence that begins, since some courses double count for both GE and majors.
because if the procedures hold, there is no other guiding principle. There is no guiding principle. There's only a discussion about how we're going to deal with D and E. I would move to strike that sentence that reads the guiding principle is that students should be able to take them.
The first two sentences? Or just
well, the first two sentences, and then the following sentence about new structures, etc., being evaluated in light of the guide, that guiding principle.
So the motion is to strike the first two sentences in the second paragraph. Is there a second? Hearing one, we move on. Senator Eileen Stearns.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Michael Smith said. In Area C, there is no confusion or dispute or problem that students will face in getting to four-unit classes. It's just actually one subcategory, Area C1, in which there are relatively few three-unit courses, which we are bringing forward a mechanism so that they will equate to four. So this is specifically about areas D and E, this three-unit class. That's nothing to do with
Area C. So, Ray?
I'm sorry, we're talking about the motion.
The main motion.
Okay. Sorry, just for a second. So I'd like to kind of jump on board with what Senator Reese is saying a little bit and say for the students, Area D exists for the university to be able to say these are all social science classes for the most part. But for students, it really is like Area X, Y, Z. Go on, because it's not how many classes you can take in Area D, it's you have to take Area D1, and then Area D2, and then Area D3. And so if the whole D category is held at 83% four-unit courses, that's great. But if D1 is all four-unit courses, and then D2 is all four-unit courses, and then the rest of the D categories kind of alter themselves to make it so that the whole D is 83.3%, it doesn't solve the problem. We still have to take extra units. Does that make sense?
I want to point out the percentages of seats offered, not of classes. And so, since approximately 20% of the classes of the seats offered every semester are in each of those areas, it would not be possible to take a full area all the way to 4 units. And definitely not 2 areas. So the total seats offered in Area D in a given semester. So one area could go essentially all to 4 units if all the rest were approved. Okay, any more discussion? The main motion. Senator.
I'm not sure. Do you have any evidence that 20% of the seats are in each given area? How I picture the GE pattern is sort of in my mind with the number of sections or courses in each of those subsections wouldn't necessarily suggest that was true. And to Brady's point is, like I said earlier, that D1 could go to 4 units, D2 could go to 4 units. Overall, 83% of the seats could be at 3 units, and the students are stuck with a 17-unit added in the area.
Has the committee looked at the distribution of seats in the different areas?
Yeah, I think that that's all came within us. I would make an argument without having a blackboard or diagram on the map works, but that essentially it is capturing the net effect on each student to measure the seat percentage within each of these areas. I'm pretty happy that it does it. If any one sub area were to increase that value for any higher, then that's really not the net effect of moving it closer to the cap. I'm confident that it's capturing. There's some scenarios in which in E and in D1, in which there are actually more seats, many more seats offered in the table on the second page than are offered in some of the other areas. So there could be some discrepancy in terms of the number of seats in each subcategory. If there are more seats available, then there are actually more free
that in a couple of places it refers to areas D and E, and I just want to be clear that, that this thing, should it pass, would be applied separately to D and to E, and not the combination of seats in the two areas. So we're looking at for a change in area E, it would require 83.3% maintenance of three in seats within E. And in area D, that would be separate, not a combination of the two.
Is that your understanding? I read it as combined.
In the present document, they are combined. They're considered a combined piece. It would be possible to split them out. And we discussed whether that would be something that could be done, but because most of these courses are all under the auspices of school social sciences, we thought that it would be better to put them all together in that way.
There's nobody on the speaker's list. Is there any objection to any debate? So it's the main motion before us with, as printed, but with the last two sentences of the last paragraph removed. That's what's going on. All of those in favor, raise your hand. Oh, keep them up. And those opposed, raise your hand. Okay, so that motion carries 18 to 10. All right. Thank you all. So, we have a time certain at 4:30, so I'm going to take one report and then do our last business item, and then we'll have the 4:30 time certain. So, President Arvaniano, do you have a report?
Since the beginning of the semester, this group met last, a couple of things have happened, kind of like this. The trigger was school on January 1st as a permanent reduction of $100 million, $2.3 million for Sonoma State. That money was, that reduction was covered globally, but in every campus, with one-time funding. Therefore, the challenge now is beginning in next fiscal year to cover that with permanent reductions. That's a challenge. Secondly, the governor released its budget, which is not a wonderful, it's not a good budget. It basically is a flat budget, meaning that the $750 million reduction, not a penny, was reduced. By the way, the University of California did receive $90 million more, will receiving under his proposal $90 million more than they did this year to cover pension costs. At the same time, the governor also has other measures in his proposal, which is based upon the successful approval by the California electorate of a tax increase measure, which has basically two pieces that most people have only concentrated on one, but they are potentially conflicting. One is an increase in the tax rate for persons making more than $250,000, the so-called millionaires. I make $250,000 and I'm three-quarters $750,000 short from being a millionaire, even under poor math. I think a second grader would know that 250 is not equal to 1,000. I think I learned that in the first grade. Second piece of that is an increase in the sales tax. The present polling shows that typically California people are in favor of increasing the taxes on the wealthier than they are, but they are at the same time not in favor of increasing the sales tax. But it is the measure is a single tax measure, meaning that it has both elements, but you are not able to split the question. And that might create some difficulty. If the tax measure is not approved, then there is another trigger for the CSU and also for the University of California of $200 million equals $4.6 million. And that we will not know that until after the November election. Before the full semester would be already almost three quarters completed by the time it happens. There's also some major changes proposed by the governor on Cal Grants, primarily increasing the eligibility for both Cal Grant A and Cal Grant B, and for as for freshmen and transfer students. It's estimated that these changes will affect at least 6,000 of our students, mostly at the current grad need section, which is the more needy part of it, and that number will grow in the next number of years. There are also other things in terms of bond measures, etc., but just none of which are helpful, but add to that. Therefore, the governor's proposed budget is pretty bad. Just to give you a bit of a statistic, the University of Illinois State University, every few years releases a report study on what they call this state tax effort per capita, $1,000 per capita income. And it shows the support of this, from the state to public higher education. California, under this study, now is being state tax effort support is back to 1962. I was a junior in high school. Many of you were not born, and some of you were probably, those who were born were in diapers. There's a group here whose parents are not even probably born. But that's where we are. We will be, and we are now being supported at 1962 levels from the state tax support. There's another study which shows that according to the governor's budget, we would be back to 1996, 1967 levels with the difference that the system would have 90,000 more students than it did in 96, 97. 90,000 is about 11 universities the size of sorry to give you nothing but bad numbers, but that's what they get. Thank you.
Questions to the president?
Actually, the Millionaires Initiative, Tax the Millionaires Initiative, is an initiative being promoted by someone other than the governor. That one being called the Millionaires Tax is being promoted by the California Federation of Teachers, not CFA, CFT. This one is just gouged the top 2%. It wasn't explicitly, he isn't advertising, he's only going after millionaires. He's going after quarter millionaires like you, too. So I just wanted to come back to his propaganda. But I did have a question, and this is about the budget. The pass-through money that we used to receive, that the governor has given us $198 million additional, but we have to pick up the revenue bonds, the general obligation bonds, the dental plan for retirees, and the any additional PERS money, not this year, but in following years. Have I got that correct? My question is about the general obligation bonds, which is, what, 189 out of 198 million. Is there any decision on, is that going to be distributed to the campuses based on the size of their general obligation bond?
There is absolutely no discussion of how that is being done. It probably would be assumed centrally, because it's not the commitment of the individual campuses, it's the commitment of the system, of the state revenue bond program.
Okay, so at this point, right now, as I understand it, if that holds up, and since there's the Democrats in the legislature are not real crazy about the whole budget, not just the CSU, we're not, I mean, as badly as we got clobbered, we're still better off than kids with illnesses. So if I understand what you're saying is that if this holds up and the 189 now becomes a permanent obligation to the CSU, I mean, that's how much money we got, and the obligation is going to go up and down. This is what I was told by people in your office, statewide, that it would be the chancellor's decision about how to distribute that, and you think it would be centrally distributed.
And remember, it's not that we will get for the first year that amount, let's say that $290 million commitment. But any fluctuation, and in most of these cases, fluctuations are upwards and not downward, it becomes the system's responsibility.
Okay, but it's not going to be distributed based on the size of your... Okay, thank you.
Senator Bass.
I was wondering if any of the searches that were announced last semester have been canceled, or are all of them going forward? For example, the dean in my school, Science and Technology, and others. Are they all going forward, or have some of them been canceled?
Some of them are going forward.
And which ones?
The dean of science is going forward. The director of the Moca Cultural Center is going forward.
And the other?
It is the vice president for Schooling and PERS.
What about the IT search?
Don't care about this one.
All right. So we'll go on to the last business item in your
presentation. Oh, sure.
All right, so the last business item is first reading of a resolution regarding the subsidization of Category 2 student fees for low-income students. This comes from the Senate Diversity Subcommittee and its co-chair, Senator Peterson.
This is in your packet, through to the last page. You may recall we brought forward a similar resolution last semester and it was referred back to our committee, where it was substantially redone, trying to incorporate many issues that have been raised in the discussion in the Senate, which we were grateful. And so at this point, it's actually much shorter on the result clause. The result clause of the Academic Senate at Sonoma State University recommends to the President that he requests that the Vice President of Administration Finance, in consultation with professional staff in ANF, find a way to address the need for subsidization of all Category 2, those of the local student fees, for all students at SSU who meet the same level of financial need as Pell Grant students, including but not limited to graduate students, those covered by AB 540, and EOP students, including identification of appropriate funding sources. The Academic Senate request this be done by no later than May 1st, 2012. So our rationale, first paragraph, stays pretty much the same in that the Pell Grant level of financial need tends to be regarded nationally as the lowest income students on a campus. And I have a footnote there that shows that at one point, 22% of the Sonoma State Conference student population was on Pell Grant, was receiving Pell Grants. I've seen other figures other years, like 25%. So it varies year by year. The level of financial aid for Pell Grant students, the top of the financial aid office, they are able, because of the FAFSA forms, those are the federal forms that students fill out to qualify for financial aid, they're able to tell us the number of students and who, the number of graduate students who qualify for Pell Grant level, and there are other students that were asked about. So we have taken out the restriction that this aid, this subsidization go just to Pell Grant recipients, and instead we changed it to people who meet the same level of financial need, because that is a known number that the financial aid office seems to be able to come up with. And for example, AB 540, which is the new Dream Act for California, I understand that the state of California will be working on a California form for analyzing the financial need of those students. So basically, as students are able to prove their financial need at that level, this would be the students who would be included. Because there were a lot of questions at this last minute about graduate students who don't qualify for Pell Grants, and so they would now be included. Credential students are already eligible for Pell Grants. So this would broaden the eligibility for this subsidization to all students at that same level of financial need. Okay, that's the first thing. And clearly, given our diversity vision statement and our mission, we do want to bring into our campus students who are at the lowest level of economic need, and so we do want to help them meet their local fees, because, as I mentioned last time, a Pell Grant does not go up to meet the local fees. Those are the fees like for the health center, the new CAPC, Counseling Psychological Services, the new fee starting when the student center opens of $150 per semester. Those fees are the local fees, and they're not covered by state grants and federal grants. All right. Secondly, we had singled out the CAPS fee initially and what would be subsidized because it was a new fee this academic year, so it seemed like a reasonable fee to look at as a beginning. And also, it was a fairly modest $50 per semester, and it seemed like something that was doable, if you will. But several people on the Senate felt that singling out one of the fees was not really what we want to do. We want to help students with as many of these Category 2 fees as possible. And so that's why it says that we'll now address the need for subsidization of all Category 2 local student fees instead of just picking out one of them. And the idea is, again, not that we're going to be able to cover all of their fees of $695 per semester immediately, but that we begin slowly. We may not be able to do $50 per semester initially, but what we want to do is find a way to set up some sort of funding to help with these fees over time, and they would be applied to those fees, which at this point, as it says in the second rationale, is $695, and that would go up when the new student center opens. Okay, so those were two major changes. Broadening it out to everyone who qualifies for a Pell Grant at that lowest level of economic need, lowest level of family income, if you will, and also to make it something that would be not just bound by the cap fee or $50, but to try to raise as much as possible towards all of these fees. And then lastly, it asks that the
Vice President of Administration of Finance, in consultation with professional staff, help develop a way for this to happen, because they're this is where the experts are, who know how money can be raised, who have ways of helping set up funds, who can initiate things, and can come back with some realistic proposals. I know one example that we've had discussions on in the diversity subcommittee, and it's been discussed in other places, is setting up a scholarship fund based on income and not just on grade point averages. So something like that, that would help with these category two fees, and that's something that's being discussed at this time. And I'm sure there are many other good ideas of things that we can do as a university to help with these fees. And so what we're asking for is some suggestions to come back by no later than May 1st, 2012.
All right, so this is the first reading, so that means major objections, suggestions for clarification or improvement, things like that. And the first reading is limited to 15 minutes. We have 8 remaining, so senators.
Two questions. One is on that last comment you made, is you said that we're asking for something by May 1st, 2012, and I'd like a clarification of what that is, because I don't think the resolution's very clear. And second, I wonder if you know what the maximum amount of a Pell Grant award is to the students who qualify for these Pell Grants.
Around $5,300
per year.
$5,300 is the maximum Pell Grant.
Something of that nature.
$5,500.
Okay, this is worth sending this entire math to me, so I think I'll be better than the last. I would suggest that you just tighten it up by saying that after a consultation with professional staff and ANF, cross out help find a way, because that's too general, and just say instead of address, say to assess the need and identify appropriate funding sources, and then go on with your sentence. So assess the need, address appropriate funding sources for substitutes. So that's a suggestion that the committee could consider bring back for a second reading.
My answer to Senator Lisa's question of exactly what the report back would be addressed.
Senator Sanghouse.
Is the development office within ANF? Is the development office within ANF? Because it seems like maybe that could be an identified source too. I could easily imagine somebody in the community saying, this is the kind of thing I would want to support. And if it were coming out of general fund, gee, that would be wonderful.
Just a comment about where we are in course of enrollment in spring. Today we have less than 100 freshmen and sophomores on less than 12 units. That's considerably less than last spring, so that's quite encouraging. At the moment we are 200 FTEs below the annualized target of 103%. We can make that up with contract courses, so we're very confident we will be on 103% or slightly below it. Good news, no penalty to someone's name. Secondly, the Academic Affairs Office put out a call for proposals to hold workshops in the spring out at the Faculty Center. We plan to hold 6 workshops. We have 13 applications. These are being passed to the Professional Development Subcommittee, who will choose the winners, if you like. And so stay tuned for that. That's it.
All right, questions for the provost. Senator, what would you count?
A question came up in APC today about the wait list and the timing of it, of why the wait list disappeared at this time after just 5 days of classes.
I can stand correcting. Melinda will probably correct me, but I believe that was the faculty requested that because it got too problematic having that wait list and people dropping into classes after they had started. So that was something we said what we're going to do. We responded to the wants of faculty, and that's why it happened.
Senator Chan.
How long are these workshops that you talk about?
I believe there's a 2-hour workshop. And what I was told today is the committee would like to choose 3 different topics and run them twice.
Thank you.
Senator Russell. Yeah, I'd just like to point out that this week was the week I needed to see the wait lists. Yeah.
We monitor the wait list fairly closely. Even yesterday, we were opening up another psychology class and targeting people on the wait list. So I believe that it's been a painful process, but we used the wait list and we would have shared them with you.
There are students who are saying, I'm still number one on the wait list, so I should get in and stuff. I
I just want to chime in as somebody who teaches the once a week Monday class that on Monday morning, literally the students checked the night before they were on the wait list. They showed up Monday morning for class, and then by the time we all left class, we discovered no wait list existed. And so it was a very, very maddening process after we had been assuring students for the whole semester before this is the way wait lists are going to work, and suddenly for those students who happen to have once a week classes on Mondays, it suddenly the rules were all changed all of a sudden, and we actually the department devised sort of a makeshift policy all of a sudden. I would much prefer it. We talked about this in our department meeting. We would much prefer it if wait lists were standard through the ad drop period, and if faculty or departments wanted to opt out at a certain point so that they could have more control over their who they chose to add or drop, that would be okay, but that it should be an opt-out process as opposed to a wholesale elimination of the waitlist.
I accept your point. I think we're all learning from the waitlist process. I certainly am. We're refining it every semester, and I've heard this complaint from a couple of people. You're not alone.
I was just going to ask if you would send your concerns via your department chair to the dean. Matt is a department seat that wanted to control it and pressure. I mean, there were one of them that were very vocal about. So we will look into whether the departments can opt out or not. We were trying this now to try to see how it works because people asked for it. So now we'll go back and fine tune it again. So make sure your chairs send that to the meeting because they're the ones who will lead the discussion.
I've heard other departments speak very forcefully that they wanted it to disappear after a point so they could reward the students who've actually been attending. So I think I would like to see this discussed in the appropriate Senate committee to find out what may work best or what exceptions may work. My question, again, I'm not sure who it's for. Maybe it's for this body. If tomorrow is the end of the ad drop period, what happens to those seats that may become available when someone drops them Friday night, but it's too late to add? Now, they could add by petition next week if they recognize there's a seat and possibly and they've been sitting in, but often that's not the case. So I'm wondering about ad drop. Is there a way to stagger a drop date sooner than the last ad date or something?
So I think I will put this on the next executive committee agenda to consider this is the right time to talk about it when we've just gone through it rather than waiting until we're setting up ready for next semester. So we'll put it on the next executive committee agenda and perhaps parcel it out to the right committee rather than like I said before you. Okay? Any more questions for the provost?
Has the Excellence in Teaching Awards information come towards you yet?
The Goldstein Award?
The Goldstein Award.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know if you wanted to announce that.
The Goldstein Awards were handed out, Nathan Rank,
yes.
And the other Heather Smith. So congratulations to those. Yeah. Right.
CFA Representative Merrifield has a report to make.
Thank you. First of all, I want to clarify something that my concerns about Western Governors University and Cal State Online should not be interpreted. California Faculty Association is opposed to online education. We have never been opposed to online education, and we're not opposed to online education. So during the discussion, if that was the impression anybody got, that is incorrect. We are sort of like, you know, then candidate for President Obama said he wasn't opposed to all boards, just dumb boards. Okay, we're opposed to dumb online education. And so far, we can't say whether Cal State Online is dumb or not because they are paying someone in excess of $100,000, they have a budget of $1 million, and they have no mission. So, you know, it's hard to criticize an organization other than that they're paying a manager who apparently doesn't have anything to do yet. But we are not opposed to online education, and I hope that I want to clarify that. Second, I want to talk very briefly about the fact that the California Faculty Association and the CSU managers management team did have a mediation session a week ago today as part of the statutory process to get negotiations back on track. I wanted to recognize at that point, as I said to the Board of Trustees Committee on Collective Bargaining the other day when I was down there, I have exactly the same view in many ways as President Armenian about the governor's budget. It's a potential disaster. It's a potential disaster similar to the potential disaster of the last several budgets. And as a result of all these bad budgets, that is why the California Faculty Association requested 18 months ago to extend the contract. And management said no. So we aren't able to work together for resources for the students, for our colleagues, and for the people of California, because we're still in contract negotiations. Contract negotiations the California Faculty Association did not want to get into. Okay, we would like to be able to work with the Chancellor's Office to get more resources for the system. We think that is very, very important, and that's why we're in mediation, and that's why we're at the bargaining table. Mediation, which is a confidential process, and so I can't go into any details. We did give specific proposals in writing that we know both sides are interested in. We were disappointed because we didn't make as much progress as we wanted to make. Nonetheless, we have additional mediation sessions planned into as far out as March if mediation continues to make progress. So we are working. Our position is very clear. We want a fair contract, and we want it very soon. And the sooner we can get a fair contract, the sooner we can work together for the benefit of the students and for our colleagues and for the state of California. So CFA did not walk away from bargaining. We are still in bargaining, and we did have a mediation session. There are a number of other things, but I am not going to be blamed for making my hard-working colleagues have to go into overtime, and there's still more reports. So I will leave it at that.
Any questions for CFA Representative Merrifield? All right. Thank you. So, Associated Students Representative Brady is next.
We're back. Believe it or not, it's almost election season for the Associated Students again. Applications are available online for students who are interested in running for office for the next academic year. So if you have any students who have shown interest throughout the year on what's gone on campus and how decisions are made, please send your best and brightest. It's really important for us that we have good students here to kind of carry the torch onward. The other thing I want to announce is we're very excited to be a part of the statewide initiative spearheaded by the California State Student Association that they've named The Buck Starts Here. And it's a campaign that's aimed at collaborating the campus communities, students, faculty, staff, administration, and aiming our frustrations at the legislature where it's rightly deserved. So the campaign is starting in San Diego, has started at San Diego State, and the concept is they've got this humongous box that all the students are going to write right on the back of mock $650 million bills, their stories on the back. So students, we encourage faculty. So what did I say?
$650
million bills.
Let me get back.
So to write their students, and then it will go from campus to campus, Olympic torch style, and end in Sacramento on May, March 5th, at the March in March, and then we will go to lobby the legislature. And so we're excited. We have the box in late February. And so we really hope that the campus community will participate and help us gather some support for refunding higher education fees.
Point out that that box and campaign will be here the same day the faculty trustee is here.
Very nice.
That was not planned. Any questions for Associate Student Representative Rainey?
Could you tell in this, the box starts here, could you describe the frightening picture in front or something?
I will bring one for you next time if you want.
Yeah.
We have those. So, yeah, they're all color coded for the campuses. So the idea is that the big plastic box would be see through and have this colorful arrangement of all the campuses joining together. And you can see that it's not just one guy wrote on the back of the stuff. But that it's thousands of students statewide.
And you have the picture of the governor.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the right.
Oh, I
see. And I'd like to suggest that you bring enough for us each to fill out at the next meeting if you have to. Okay. All right, so Chairman Purser.
Yes. Speaking of election pitches, I would like to follow on one for the ASI elections by reminding people to open up their email boxes and grab that email that Moral just sent out earlier today. We're still looking for people to run for office for next year in faculty governments. Like Executive Vice President Rainey said, it's a great opportunity, it's a growth opportunity. You can learn a lot by running for office, and there's some great faculty out there to run for these positions. I can update that memo a little tiny bit by announcing that Secretary Hess has agreed to put her hat in the ring once again as secretary, so it's not the case that we have no nominations. In fact, we have one nomination. But it would be great to have more nominations. Also, keep an eye on her, that same inbox, fairly early next week, when you'll be seeing the rationale description for the constitutional vote on the constitutional amendment about the structure of faculty governance will go out. Those two elections will happen at the same time, and that's going to be something that I think as academic senate members, we're going to have to be able to help our colleagues understand and be able to explain what's going on with that. So,
any questions for Chairman Purser? All right. So, standing committee reports, APC, Senator Roberts, Senator Harvey Ducati.
Thank you. APC had its first meeting today, and we pretty much set our goals for the semester, and the tasks that we laid out so far was, one, to create and design the online course policies, so that is being taken up now, updating an existing MOU with extended education, and we discussed the creation of a resolution regarding intentionality of funding as being guided by academic priorities. That was pretty much what we accomplished today.
Questions for APC? All right. The APC chair is not here. Faculty standards and affairs, Senator Sanghoff?
Yes. Well, one of the things that we are happy to see is Madeline Rose's nomination for emeritus status. We put out a call. You might have seen it. We'd like to encourage you to respond. We have a task force that's working on looking at the SETIs, and there's three different threads that we're looking at. We're trying to get a sense of best practices and assessment, what's known about assessment. So if you have that as an area, or know, maybe you have grad students who are working on those kinds of issues, we got a project for them. And we also are looking for anyone who's interested in implementation issues or if there's other aspects to that. So you can respond to any of the three members of the task force, Chip McCauley, Vicky Montero, and Sandra Newton, or if you can't remember who that was and you lost the email, you can send it my way and I'll route it to them. And part of what we're looking at is just to say, do we need to reform it in general, or are tweaks going to be enough? That's part of the things that we're doing to see what we can move the SETIs forward into this 21st century. Let's see, I think that's the main thing. I do know that we have coming up on future agendas, we will be dealing with the sabbatical policy revision. We're planning on bringing that to the Senate floor this semester, we'll have something a bit more substantive by our next meeting, and then I might be able to predict how soon it will be coming in. But if you have comments or concerns about the sabbatical policy, please let your FSAC rep know. And we'll also be addressing the textbook instructional materials adoption policy. We're really trying to move that forward because it really does matter for the students that we identify those in time for a range of reasons. Affordability, some of it's got to do with making them accessible, but also we have students who, through rehabilitation programs and other things like that, have to order all their books at once, and they have to go through this amazing gauntlet just to get their books there, and it can take weeks. So we really, you know, if we're wanting to teach our students and we want them to read the materials, we've got to make them accessible. All right, that's it.
Thank you. Any questions for FSAC? All right. Student Affairs Committee, Senator Bernabe.
Just briefly, the Student Affairs Committee has been working on the student referenda, fee referenda election code, I think what it's called. We've been collaborating with people and associated students. Now we have a draft. The draft has gone out to associated students and to the fee advisory committee. SAC has taken a look at it, and pretty soon I'm sure we'll be bringing it to the Senate.
Questions for Student Affairs? Senator Bass.
Do any of you have a discussion this week on what's happening with the Multicultural Center?
We did not.
Did you report on that?
We were really late on humans in our meeting. Everyone was sick.
I was going to ask Matthew, but this question is it's not clear if it's being staffed at all this semester.
So, do you want to answer?
I don't have the vote. Yeah, you can do much better.
Senator.
Right, I'm on the advisory board for the Multicultural Center and on the search committee too, and we had evidently a freeze of the search, but then President Arwagana or whomever found the funding, funded the search once again, so we just met and we're really excited about the candidates that are coming. It seems like we've had so many meetings after all, and so no, it's not staffed right now. But it will be.
Any more questions for Student Affairs? Okay. Staff Representative Bainter, would you like to make a report?
Yes, thanks. Wanted to update everybody that looks like we have a meeting coming up in February with the union to talk about the ratification, possible ratification of contract for the CSUU, so that's exciting. Also, the Staff Development Committee just started its third in a row, I think, 10-week Tai Chi Chuan session for staff, and that's on Fridays in ICB from 12 to 1. And the last thing is, if you could please encourage the staff in your areas to think about running for the staff representative position, because I'm at the end of my third year here, and I think it would be good for you to show that you're interested in having the staff members in the office.
Great.
What
would
this break
bring? Thank
you. Any questions for staff representative? Senator Chan. Do
you get release time for being the representative? No.
I mean,
release time. All right. Any items for the committee orders?
Yeah, I have a question. I had a chance to check the GMC site. Am I find ticket information there? I've had actually members of the community ask me about how to go go about putting tickets for a Lifeline concert at the summer?
March 12th. That's when that, by March 12th, that's the goal for the ticket system being operational. That's the goal date for announcing the season and making tickets available.
Do you know the prices? Do anybody know?
I don't know.
There has been a conversation about yes, there will be yes, not for certain, but there's been lots of conversation and encouragement about having tickets less expensive for students. I don't think anything said in stone yet, the best of knowledge, there certainly is a price lockdown for students.
Any other items? Any words? Senator Cabanas? I
wanted to remind everyone that Black History Month starts next week, and there will be a Thursday evening, February 2nd. There is a talk on I am always the one I wanted to marry. And then there are other events. The big speaking event will be February 8th with Dr. Lamont Hill. And he'll also be providing a workshop for students that day. That's February 8th at 3 p.m. in the multi-purpose room of the student union. So there are flyers. Bruce Berkowitz forwarded these, or I forwarded those. But if you'd like flyers for Black History Month, I can get them to you. And I believe there's going to be a kickoff at the Multicultural Center. There was going to be at the beginning of February, but I'm not sure about that now.
All right. Thank you. Any more? Senator Chan.
To address the diversity students with the extra fees, I would like to ask the Senate Chair to begin a conversation with the Development Office, with the President and Vice President, to start scholarship for those students. I think that's something tangible we can do right away. There are many faculty members that have family scholarship, so you can ask some of the faculty to have to change their family scholarship to accept or allow the university student to apply without adhering to a high standard of grade. And also, on our campus, we have very few administrators who have to honor to start scholarship. So perhaps we can approach administrators to start scholarship. It really is amazing to make you feel really good all the time, all year round, to be able to give a scholarship. So I just like to ask people on my left and the left, yes, to encourage other administrators, because I think that's the most wonderful thing to do. I did mine when my father was close to terminal cancer. And one day I just decided to do one. And I didn't have my checkbook. And Dr. Ludman was walking by. I said, hey, would you be my first donor? And he did. He wrote a check for $50. That's how I started my family scholarship. So I hope that that if you already have a scholarship, you encourage other people to do it.
All right. Thank you for the suggestion. I will take that up and have a conversation with the President about the scholarship opportunities. All right, we are adjourned.